You're listening to the Prestige 70 Podcast, a collection of intimate conversations with contemporary jazz artists with an eye toward the genre-defining music made on Prestige Records.
On today's Prestige 70 Podcast, my guest, he became immersed in jazz as a teenager and began his career at the renowned Dorsey High School Jazz Workshop. Post-high school, he was playing local clubs, and by age 19, he had joined Elvin Jones' band. After 3.5 years, he joined a quartet led by the pianist McCoy Tyner. He's currently leading the Azar Lawrence Experience, which features both standards and his own original compositions. Azar Lawrence, welcome to the Prestige 70 Podcast.
Thank you for having me.
So you heard the saxophone, I think for the first time, when a friend of your father's brought a sax. Yeah, to your house.
That's correct. Interestingly enough, I was at the time trying to find an instrument that would express where my voice had dropped. Mm-hmm. It was lower. My hearing, everything was lower. And I was thinking about a cello. But then I said to myself, well, that's going to be interesting transporting, you know. I was debating. And we were blessed. We had a swimming pool up in Baldwin Hills. Mm-hmm. And my father's co-worker used to come, and he would lay on by the pool and play his flute. One time he brought an alto saxophone. And when I heard that, I just went, oh, that's it, that's it. Because he could play, too.
Yeah.
And so, my father was a big supporter, and he said, let's go get you one, boy. So we went out and got one.
When did you start listening to jazz? When did that
All along. My mother was a pianist. Uh-huh. But she was a school teacher, sixth grade school teacher. And she always played the KBCA 105.1 jazz station in the car. When she got out, if we were both, my brother and I were both in the car, when she'd get out and go in the store or something, he'd turn it to KGFJ, the R&B station.
R&B station.
When she got back, she said, turn that back. So we listened to, My Favorite Things. So John Coltrane was on.
Right.
I remember that,
Yeah.
You know, Joe Henderson, Horace Silver.
You were also friendly with the son of a very famous saxophone player.
That's very true.
Tell me about Reggie Golson.
Reggie Golson. I met him at a Sunday Horace Tapscott concert. Used to be at Fauchet Junior High School every Sunday. And we just hit it off immediately. And I don't know if I should compromise myself and say that jumped the fence from the high school and meet him. Oh, boy. After Jazz Workshop, another great teacher, Dr. Simpson, for the Dorsey Jazz Workshop, who actually, a few of my friends, the students that went to him, we called him. He's in his 80s now, not too long ago, about 6 months ago, and got in touch with him. But yeah, so Reggie, we would go up to his house, and they lived in Hollywood Hills at the very top. There was nowhere to go after their house. That was it.
Yeah.
And
off the canyon into the valley.
That's it.
Yeah. I'm wondering if you at all had any discussions with Benny Golson about his experiences in jazz and music.
Well, you know what? That came through Reggie. Mm-hmm. Reggie was very close with Elvin Jones, and he was very close with Duke Ellington. He was very close with John Coltrane. He still had some John Coltrane of his reeds. But Benny Golson told me a lot of things about the saxophone. He didn't go into his history, but Reggie would tell me about his father and who he played with, and that he knew from what Benny had told him.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Sure. Well, and Benny grew up with John Coltrane. They were just young guys in Philadelphia.
Yeah.
You know, trying to figure out, the music game at the time. You eventually ended up playing with Horace Tapscott.
Yeah, I did. As a matter of fact, yeah, after one of those Sundays there, I was introduced to Horace and ooh.
And you were playing clubs around Los Angeles at that point?
Well,
or?
I did play a club, I mean, formally with Larry Gales, Candy Finch, who was Larry Gales, a bass player from Thelonious Monk.
Yeah, yeah.
And Candy Finch, who had played 5 years with Dizzy Gillespie, the drums.
Yeah.
And Woody Shaw, George Cables, and myself. Larry and Candy had a club. Yeah, LB West on 54th Street. It was from 2 a.m. to 6.
Wow.
Tuesdays and Thursdays.
That's amazing.
Isn't that something?
That's amazing. I don't think any of that exists anymore, which is which is somewhat sad, and you know, in many respects. How were you introduced to Elvin Jones?
Well, it's back to Reggie Golson.
Mm.
Yeah, Reggie had spoken with Elvin, and we were gonna. He said, "Come on, Aza." I mean, I was at his house every day, he was like, "I want you to come on. Let's go out and pick Elvin and his wife up at the airport." And so he had. He used to have a bug, a Volkswagen bug, but then he had just gotten a Volkswagen wagon, which worked perfectly.
Yeah.
So we picked him up, and you know, Elvin and Keiko sat back. I was introduced, and we dropped him off at the Players Hotel. And went out to see him at the lighthouse that night.
Mm-hmm.
So Reggie said, "Bring your horn, man, bring your horn." So I brought my soprano. And Elvin walked up behind me and he said, "Yeah, you might get a chance to use that thing." I was like, I thought maybe I was going to sit in. I was ready though.
Yeah.
But, you know, but no, I didn't get a chance to do that. But afterwards, they invited me to come to a rehearsal the next day. And what had happened is Dave Liebman had left and gone to Miles Davis. And so it just left Steve Grossman and Gene Perla.
Mm-hmm.
I played and packed up my horn. And I was ready to go. And he said, "You're with me, aren't you?"
Just like that?
Just like that, yeah.
Just like that.
Yeah.
Wow. So tell me about getting to the tenor.
So, interesting enough, I was doing quite a bit on alto, and I was doing the baritone thing with Horace Tapscott.
Yeah.
Raymond Pounds, a drummer that did a lot with Stevie Wonder, but also played on the Marvin Gaye Trouble Man album. Mm-hmm. He's a friend of mine, and he said, "Well, you know what?" He said, "You need to get a man's horn, play that tenor." And he said, "Oh," I said, "Really?" So once again, my father, you know, stepped up and
God bless him.
Yeah,
God bless him. But what is it about the tenor? I mean, in your mind, I mean, that's a great description, you know, time for, a man's horn.
Yeah.
But what is it about the tenor that is different than playing alto or baritone?
Well, just the range, I mean, that's where my voice is actually, you know, I think I'm a tenor.
Mm-hmm.
It's more right in where my thinking, my mind, the energy follows the thought, you know.
Right.
Of the sound is following that energy from within, and it's the center of it is what we call tenor.
Yeah.
And it just fit. I mean, because alto, I could actually hear, I could play what I heard in my head on alto. But I kept playing, I couldn't go low enough on the alto. I would carry the lowest note and try to bend it on my leg, and I just couldn't. It wasn't enough.
Yeah.
Wasn't enough.
Yeah, couldn't get down there.
Yeah, couldn't go. I was hearing lower, you know. So it was perfect. And then as soon as I changed, the very day I changed, I started working.
Yeah. Was there a fair amount of wood shedding that you had to do once you picked up the tenor?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, because everything was in a different key.
Mm.
Blues and F was my G, you know. I mean, now, you know.
So now you're transposing.
Transposing.
As much as, you know. And then you start thinking as opposed to actually playing.
Right.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah. So you go to this rehearsal, to get back to the story, you go to this rehearsal with Elvin Jones, and I'm wondering what challenges that presented to you in terms of playing with a drummer like Elvin Jones?
Well, just all of the listening that had been done on record, you know, with him playing all that beautiful stuff they played with John Coltrane's group, and the mystique of, you know, this famous great man, and then he is great, and there he is now, you know, being great. you're there listening to it, and
But it's one thing to listen to it on the record.
Oh,
it's another thing entirely. All of a sudden, be in the room.
Oh yeah,
and
being, I mean, you know, listening that way is one thing too, but now you're actually engaging in, you know, co-creating with this man, and he was interesting to his the advanced concept that he had of time was so fluid that you know, it was fluid.
Yeah.
So therefore, we are used to at a certain stage of elementary musical experience and knowledge, you know, holding on to these bars in our mind, you know, 16, I mean.
Right, you're counting.
You're counting, you know, some ever so slightly perhaps. And,
right.
And when you start to let go of that so you can really immerse yourself in the music and create, then now is how deeply rooted is it within you that you can count as, I mean, you know, you are it, you know, it's not mentally counting now, but you feel the actual bars, you know, the timing that it's time, when it's time to change, and then when the changes are coming, you've done it so much that now that it's a part of you. Mm. You had to be there to create and still be rooted in the song, because the form, AABA form, you know, those things, I mean, and where most drummers would put one bass drum or a cymbal, he might go past that. He might have put it on a bass drum, or he might have put it on a tom. I mean, it's there. You know, how he did it is hard to describe.
Yeah.
But, and it was really a lot of Afro influence. It was like sometimes you'd be in a jungle with it. I mean, it was like you were in, you know.
It strikes me that requires a remarkable amount of self-confidence for you as a musician, you know, to be kind of, you know, kind of rooted in the understanding of, I understand, you know, my sense of time.
Right.
And how that works with a drummer like that.
Well, that's absolutely the, you hit it, the nail on the head, in the sense that you had to be firmly rooted in your sense of time.
Yes.
You couldn't rely on him. Mm. Which we're used to doing, relying on the drummer to do it. You have to know the form yourself. And so therefore, you know, then you can meet up, we can meet up at these points.
Right. And to me, that's, I mean, that's almost the essence of jazz music, you know, at almost at its core. And particularly that music that bebop was moving toward, you know, and you know, so much of the, you know, the great stuff that we hear on so many of the great prestige, you know, records that Coltrane made,
absolutely,
you know, all of that rhythmic kind of intensity was moving in that direction.
Yes, it was. Slowly, but ever so.
Yeah,
slightly.
Yeah. He was. I mean, he had his own sense of time.
Yes.
In terms of, you know, the way he progressed.
That's very true. As
a musician. Did Elvin talk to you at all, speaking about Coltrane, did he talk to you at all about Coltrane?
I asked him one time in a moment of clarity, I said, how can you play with a guy like me after playing with a guy like John Coltrane? He snapped. He said, is that what you're thinking about? He said, is that what you're thinking about?
Busted.
Yeah, but that was, I left it at that.
Yeah, never asked him again.
Never asked him again.
Hmm. Did Elvin give you, forgetting about Coltrane, but did he give you advice about your playing? Did he not direct you per se, but encourage you in some way?
Interesting you asked that. That's a good question. Only thing he told me, he said, listen, he said, you are a master of the physical saxophone. You are over that. He said, just play music now.
Isn't that great? You know, don't worry about the technical.
He said, you got it.
Just play.
Yeah, he said, you've mastered that. Just play some music.
Hmm. What did that mean to you when you heard something?
Let your fingers go. Let your hands go. If you're a boxer, they said, let your hands go. Let your fingers go.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I was able to do that, and that was one of my fortes. And I would let people, prior to that, if you were to hire me, I would say, listen, the only thing I can guarantee is that I can get out of the way and let the Most High come through me.
Yeah. 3.5 years, right, with Elvin Jones?
Well, I lived with him 2.5 years. And then after a period that I had done the Miles and the McCoy Tyner thing, then he wanted me to come back, and I came back as I moved out to California.
I see. But there was but you did get introduced to McCoy Tyner.
I met McCoy at a Horace Tapscott, the Sunday thing.
You performance.
Know? Yeah, performance. Yeah. And he had written a new song, and he was trying to get the right drum beat on there.
McCoy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And Wilby Fletcher was playing drums with us. Uh-huh. And we were at a rehearsal, and he was like, that's not right. Try this. And so then, Guilherme Franco, the percussionist, said, let me try. So he went there and sat down and played what was supposed to have been a Brazilian thing, and McCoy said, oh, that's it. But it was funk. Boom, ba-bow, ba-boom, ba-boom, ba-boom. Yeah, this Brazilian thing, boom, boom, bop. That's the funk. Those all came from Africa.
Yeah.
All this music.
Right.
The Brazilian music, all of this was the roots, you know. And so therefore, you know, I said at that very point, I had to drop certain parameters that I had formed into fences for myself. I had also listened to an album that Sonny Rollins had done. It was a funk album. On Milestone, Fantasy Under the Umbrella. So I said, there is this man that has most likely invented bebop.
Yeah.
Has done a funk album.
Yeah.
Now, what do I look like saying, oh, I'm not playing that. I'm not, you know, wait a minute. You know, I'm a jazz. Yeah.
Coming back to McCoy.
Yes.
I'm assuming you were familiar with his work before you got to sit in with him.
Absolutely.
But, yeah.
Back to Reggie Golson. Reggie Golson had a record collection the size of this room.
Hmm.
He had, and all we did is he'd play, okay, what about this? You know this one? No, I don't know. And he'd play that. Then he'd go and talk to his father. Then he'd come back and he'd play this. And out of all that music, McCoy, that was the sound. Man, I play this one again. Because, you know, McCoy, you know, oh, man, those albums, he and Joe Henderson, he and McCoy, and John Coltrane, you know, that sound that of the piano, that was like, ooh, I love that. You know,
I think you used the term playing with him was like, just his piano playing was like playing with an orchestra.
Oh, yes.
Just describe what that means to you.
Well, just his voicing. He himself described it as that his concept was based upon horn shouts.
Hmm.
Yeah, so that's where he was coming from. Like on Africa Brass,
mm-hmm.
you know, actually mm-hmm. those things that Eric Dolphy wrote out were what he was playing.
Yeah.
And so those horn shouts that Eric turned into the actual horn shouts were what McCoy had, you know, according to McCoy. And that's how he orchestrated his compositions and with the internal compositions within the compositions.
Mm.
And this is, you know, the way he composed. It was from an orchestral standpoint.
Yeah.
You know, you were immersed in an ocean of music and tones and this way he would build his chords.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
How did that affect your playing? What did you have to do to play with him?
We fit together like a glove. It was like, I knew it would. I mean, he was who I really, you know, looked forward to playing with. Mm. It's interesting because I had a, after seeing him at the Horace Tapscott thing, you know, I met him and he was going up to San Francisco to the Keystone Corner.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So I drove up there. It was on Sunday night and told the man I was tired, so I went to the hotel. Mm-hmm. And it was enough time. I asked the hotel to give me a wake-up call. And they called me like around 10 to 12 or something. When I got over there, they were packing up. So he said, I'll see you in New York, man. So what happened is the way I got a chance to play with him is, you know, Elvin Jones, and we would come play at the Vanguard, the Village mm-hmm. Vanguard, and I could see on the schedule that McCoy would be there next week. But we would always leave town. We were working. And so Alphonse Mouzon came and said, oh, man. He said, that's the sound. I'm going to tell McCoy, that's the sound we need for the group. He said, if you're in town, come down next week and I'll tell McCoy you can sit in. Well, I knew we were going out of town, so. But then the gig fell through. They got canceled.
Huh.
So I was in town. So I went down there and, you know, McCoy said, you know, reintroduced himself and we talked and Alphonse said, come on up and Sonny Fortune was there and he started playing this song and here I am. I don't know what key it's in. I don't know anything. So I asked Sonny and he just said like this. So I didn't know what that meant. But that, but I guess that,
I'm guessing.
Yeah, I've been guessing
it's
guessing
C. It's C.
And I didn't want to try it out to see, you know, but anyway, though, so I did my thing and I just walked off. He walked off that way and was talking to people and I was getting ready to leave. People were, oh man, sound good, this and that. And so it was interesting because as soon as Sonny walked, I noticed as soon as Sonny Fortune walked up the steps of the Vanguard, he left everybody and came over to me and said, hey buddy, he said, you like playing music? I said, well, yeah, that's what I'm out here doing. You know, that's what I'm out here for.
Yeah.
And he asked me a few questions like that, you know, yeah, man, you know, I really liked it. That was nice. And so I gave him my information. The next day, I was staying in Arlington, Virginia with my son and his mother. And mm-hmm. So I had gone down there, mm-hmm. you know, and so. And they said, hey, is there a telephone call? So I said, hello? Hey, buddy, this is McCoy. I was like, they probably still can hear this yell. I'm still bouncing off the mountains. I yell so loud. They came running and was like, you okay? They thought I had lost my mind or something. Oh, yeah. He said, oh, man. He said, buddy, I really enjoyed it. You know, I want you to go to Europe with me and stuff. So you'll join the band. I was like, oh, absolutely.
Sign me up. And the next thing you know is you're at Montreux.
I don't like saying I'm at Montreux.
Only, you know, the premier jazz festival potentially in the world.
That's true.
Who did you, I mean, in addition to the experience of playing, tell me about who you saw there and who you ran into in the whole scene.
You know all about that, then?
A little bit.
Oh, man. Oh, it was, you know, Dizzy Gillespie. Cannonball Adderley, I was standing backstage and he came over to me and McCoy. He said, I went and saw Gato Barbieri last night. He said, all the big hype and everything that they, he said, but when I heard you were doing the stuff that I thought he should have done with all that big buildup, you know.
So here you are, I don't know how old you were at this point, but you were.
I just turned 21 when I got
21.
with McCoy.
21. And you're on the stage at Montreux.
Yes.
Clearly understanding sort of the level of importance that that particular festival means in the world of jazz. Tell me about if you recall, tell me about your thought process as you're walking on that stage.
There was two steps that led up to the level of the. From the dressing or that room right before the stage. And you had, as I walked between, I had to pass, I passed Sonny Stitt. They were standing on each side, and Cannonball Adderley was standing on each side. I had to pass between the two of them to get on stage. And they were like, yeah, man, do it, do it, do it. And my knees started shaking, though.
No pressure.
No pressure. Oh, man, I was like, okay. So then I shook that off, and then I got out there, and then right in the front row was Woody Shaw and Bobby Hutcherson. Looking like, I was like, oh, okay, it's going to be one of those things. So then quickly got into the, you know, into the vibe with McCoy. And, it was just, and Junie Booth and Alphonse were wild, crazy people up on stage. And see, the interesting thing about it is, though, the day before at about 3:30 in the morning, it was the Land of the Midnight Sun, mm-hmm. in the Kongsberg, Norway. McCoy had called me and said, hey, buddy, you know, you awake? I said, yeah, absolutely. You know, he said, you want to play some music? I said, yeah. He said, come on down, meet me down in the lobby. So they had a room with a piano, and he and I went back, and he showed me the songs that later became the Enlightenment Suite.
Wow.
So there was no written music. It was
for the Enlightenment Suite.
For the Enlightenment Suite.
Wow.
You know, nothing written. And so the next time I saw McCoy, and then I caught up with him, it was at the sound check. Mm. We played a couple of the songs. We didn't play all the songs. We touched on them. And then the next thing, we recorded.
Yeah. In addition to that, I mean, you were on three of, you know, arguably his finest records, mm-hmm. you know, Enlightenment, Sama Layuka, and Atlantis. Right. Why do you think that partnership, that collaboration, works so well?
I think it was just made in heaven. Mm. And, you know, if you believe in past life or reincarnation, of continuation of work, mm-hmm. I think that we're of a family that is of that lineage. Mm. And, you know, when we've reunited to continue some work.
Yeah.
Elvin, too. Mm. Yeah.
You know, and I have the same question about McCoy that I asked you about Elvin. What did he say to you about your playing? And did he offer, you know, again, not direction, but encouragement, mentorship in some way?
Well, he told me the same thing my manager, Tracy Hanna, has been telling me recently. Use vibrato, it helps make the sound big. But I asked him the same question. I said, how could you play with a guy like me after playing with a guy like John Coltrane? He said, I just think that you feel the same way about music as John did.
Hmm.
That was his answer.
That
was significant.
Yeah. I mean, that's got to be validation.
Yeah,
you know, as a musician, are there things, particularly as you were working with him, on those three records, what was most surprising to you about his playing and his compositional sense?
Well, the only surprise that I had about McCoy, since we were in one accord, without saying a word,
yeah,
just the way he felt about it, I felt about it, and. Was that since he and I were very close, he was telling me, he was like, yeah, man. He said, Yamaha's going to give me a piano. I said, what about the one you have? He said, well, I don't even have a piano. Uh-huh. I was like, you don't have a piano at home? He said, well, I got that old spinet. It's out of tune and everything that he brought when he first joined the John Coltrane Quartet. And he said, you know, it's all out of tune. He said, I use that sometimes. I write from that. He said, the out of tuneness. I used to write, so
that is amazing.
But he said, I finally said, I feel like I want to work on some stuff, and that's what he meant by practice.
Mm-hmm.
So that means all this time he's not.
It's coming from here,
or
here, or you know, wherever.
Yeah, it's not. He wasn't there practicing, and the longest we were off would be a month at any given time. You know, we would that's after back to back months. Of playing Tuesday through Sunday, traveling on Monday, doing it again.
Mm.
And so, I was like, wow. So you say, I feel like working on some stuff now. So that meant feel like practicing. Yeah. Playing with McCoy is how I got introduced to Prestige and Orrin Keep News.
Mm-hmm.
I was on the, after we did the Enlightenment album, we were on the yacht cruise out there in the Alps. Which, by the way, we just came back from.
Boy, that's pretty good, I gotta say. That sounds great.
Yeah, we were I had called a friend of mine, a lady friend of mine that I was very close with. Well, actually, the mother of my son.
Hmm.
I was calling her, so I had an $800 phone bill. And so, Orange Key News can say,
charge it to the label.
Yeah, he said, we took care of your phone bill. I was like, oh, that's nice. So, nice. I didn't know who they were. You know. So, thanks very much. So then he started talking. He said, we love what you're doing, and we'd like to sign. Which, you know, we'd like to sign you to.
You must have been aware who Orange Key News was.
I really
you
was.
Were not.
No, I don't know who he was, except that his relationship to McCoy.
Hmm.
I didn't know that he was, you know.
He was a dude.
Yeah, the dude. And he was a nice cat too.
Yeah.
Oren.
Yeah, I got to meet him once.
Did you?
Yep. They're fantastic. But that, you know, again, it comes back to so many points in your career. You have been working with these remarkable people in jazz music, who continue to kind of validate your path. Is that how you took it?
Yeah, you know, it just came. I mean, in a technical standpoint, and in a real sense, that is what is happening. And, and to me, it was because of the laws of attraction, where it's stated that each soul will, during their lifetime, will attract to them what they need for growth and development.
Mm.
So it was according to that, and through meditation, daily meditation, and you know, trying to go right thinking, and you know, and you know, living in thoughts and all, you know, that you would start to emanate a positive vibration and attract the positive things and what you need for growth and development on your path. So that's where I was at with it. These are all the things that are coming.
Well, it seemed to be working. That's you know, that's for sure. So, speaking of going along your path, you did have the opportunity to work with Miles.
Yes.
And you know, without going too deeply, you know, into Miles and his character, but certainly, you know, it's well known that he was not necessarily the easiest cat to work with. Tell me about your experience with him.
Very wise.
Mm-hmm.
Very.
How so?
He explained, the very first time we spoke on the phone, he explained a concept of atonality to me that was so heavy and so deep that for about 10 years or more, every so often a part that he told me would come out. I'd be like, oh, wow, that's what he said.
Huh.
Oh, man. He was like... And then as far as, I didn't have to ask him about the John Coltrane thing. I asked him, should I bring, I you know, I heard that, you know, the tenor players that you have, you restrict them.
Mm-hmm.
You want them to just play soprano.
Mm-hmm.
He said, you can bring anything you want. He said, you can play bassoon if you want. He said, because I haven't heard tenor saxophone like this since Train. That's what he told
Whoa.
Me. Yeah.
Okay, well, that's a good place to be. Okay, so very quickly, you had the chance to play with Jaco Pastorius, which I did not know until I found out yesterday, courtesy of someone who's sitting in the room here. But it fascinates me because he was such a commanding presence.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in the rhythm section, I'm guessing it's not unlike having played with Elvin Jones, in that there's so much going on rhythmically that you have to find kind of your place there. Is that how you found working with him, or am I completely off?
Well, working with Jaco was just like a walk in the park. I mean, you know, after Elvin and McCoy, everybody has just been a walk in the park after that. Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, and Jaco's he was a close friend of mine. He was, I met him when I was with McCoy at the Berlin Jazz Festival, and he wasn't the big guy, you know, he became. And I befriended him, you know, we became, you know, hey, what's up? So then we were on, you know, that's how we were.
Mm.
And it's interesting because in my group I have now, the Azar Lawrence Experience.
Yes.
we were had gone through a period of looking for some bass players, and the bass player that we have now reminds me of the way he plays. He's got a Jaco kind of thing.
And
that's one of the things I learned working with Jaco. Jaco played like a horn player. He played the bass. He told me, he said, "Look, man, I always wanted."
He studied horn players.
Yeah,
I mean, he listened to them.
Yes.
Yeah.
Wayne. He was very close to the saxophone. He wanted to be a saxophone player. I told him I'd give him some lessons, but
yeah, yeah.
But back to or forward to what you were saying about the John Coltrane being more a cerebral, the mental factor.
Yeah.
In terms of the way we feel the music, and I agree with that. It inspired a lot of thought. The Love Supreme, in particular, inspired a lot of thinking, and hopefully people became better and for it, and opened up some centers and the cranium, and
And it still resonates.
That's today. That's what that was. Those tones were there to do that, to open up certain centers and. Pineal gland, inspire those and stimulate that. And McCoy's touch is warm and brings the heart center to, when I'm speaking of centers, the endocrine, the centers of the seventh.
Well, one other thing I want to touch on, I know that there's a record of unreleased material.
Absolutely.
That is going to come out. Tell me about the record, when it was recorded, who was on it.
Yeah, the late 70s, I recorded a record, a solo album, and right now it's called, what is it called? Well, we haven't gotten a name for it, but we're thinking about some names.
Sure.
So,
who's on the album?
The album features Elvin Jones on drums, Ron Carter on bass, Roland Prince on guitar, and Albert Daly on piano. Albert Daly we became friends, a great pianist, Stan Getz, all those great singers, Nancy Wilson, all those, Sarah Vaughan. Albert told me that he was asked to join John Coltrane's quartet before McCoy. And did not want to fulfill the requirement of moving his family to from Baltimore to New York to be in a band. Mm. And another tidbit is that Benny Golson told me that he and John Coltrane were at the house, and McCoy was driving his family up the turnpike to join Benny Golson's group, and his car broke down. John Coltrane had a car, Benny did not. And so Benny asked John to go down and get him. Mm-hmm. They never made it back.
The funny thing is, Benny told me that story.
Did he say that story?
He told me that story.
Unbelievable.
I love that. So very quickly, tell me about the Azar Lawrence experience.
Yeah, so the Azar Lawrence experience is a group now. It's eight pieces when I use the vocalist. Mm-hmm. I'm playing an updated version of the original music that recorded and written during the period I was recording with Prestige.
Yeah.
And but it's I call it a treatment. I put a time treatment on the time was now. Mm. So it's got a 2019, 2020, 21, 25.
Awesome.
Treatment, new age treatment, but the roots are based upon and are the music in my Summer Solstice album, which, by the way, is soon to be released as well. It's going to be reissued because, although the one that we are with Elvin and Ron and Albert, it's unreleased.
Well, and I'm sure people can keep track of you online and figure out where you're going to be and hopefully come out.
AzarLawrence.com.
Yeah. Hopefully come out and see you play. Azar Lawrence, thank you so much.
Thank you, Scott.
For doing this. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Prestige Records.
You bet. You bet.
You'll find additional episodes of the Prestige 70 podcast at craftrecordings.com/Prestige70 or wherever you download podcasts. This episode was brought to you by Craft Recordings, crafting the future from the past. edited by Zach Stilwell and produced by Laura Saez. I'm Scott Goldman. Thanks for listening.
Look around. You can find cars like these on AutoTrader. New cars, used cars, electric cars, maybe even flying cars. Okay, no flying cars, but as soon as they get invented, they'll be on AutoTrader. Just you wait. AutoTrader.